This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, it seems that everybody claims to be for reforming the police these days. But we'll speak with an author who says police reform is impossible because violence is at the center of the cops' contract with the state. And some of the world's wealthiest people try to reconcile their vast riches by giving billions to charity. But we'll speak with an activist who says we need to get rid of charity by getting rid of poverty. But first, activists from around the country brought their anti-war message to the headquarters of U.S. Wars last Sunday. Black Agenda Report was there for the Women's March on the Pentagon.
This is Bruce Dixon at the Pentagon on October 21, 2018, and I'm talking to
Lisa Davis. I am currently representing the People's Organization for Progress here at the March on the Pentagon, but I'm also a member of the Black is Back Coalition for Peace, Justice, and Reparations.
So what do you think about the military as a solution for black youth here?
The military is no kind of a solution. The military is based on destruction and war and U.S. imperialism, which basically means stealing the resources from people who happen to be non-white all over the world and using it for their benefit and instilling the resources. It's stealing their land, their history, their culture, their physical destruction of their bodies and of their minds. So you can know I am definitely anti-war, anti-imperialism.
Your elected officials, especially the black ones in New Jersey, are any of them opposed to the wars that we're involved in?
I don't even think that they are even aware that we are even have a war. They act like they don't care because they don't. And they never bring it up. That's one of the things that I'm extremely disappointed about, because I think that this movement, every movement, the black people involved in the black liberation struggle, people on the front lines of the homelessness and everything, should be making war and stopping the war a primary issue in these elections. And no candidate at all should be able to talk to anyone without stating their position on these wars, these immoral, unjust wars.
Why are we here?
Well, this is a very important moment for women to raise enough their voices against war, against this racist, imperialist, patriarchal war that has been imposed by the United States in many territories, including mine in Colombia, because the money that the United States have put in Colombia to help the militarization in our territories is fueling the war that we suffer today in lands in Afro descent and in black lands in Colombia. So it's a women's movement here. It is a great momentum for women to be heard, to be spoken really loud against this war and against these imperialist intentions of the United States in other countries, but also here in the United States, because the war that is put it outside of the United States is coming back in different ways, you know, economic violence, the police violence against black people here in the United States, the violence against women here in the United States. Those are repercussions of this tendency to be, to this aggressive tendency to be on war all the time, this war mentality of this culture and this country. So it's very important today having women from all around the country and many other countries speaking up here and making clear that we don't want any more war here, outside of the United States, and any other country.
Some of our Democratic politicians in the United States, especially black ones, are advancing the military as a career, as a solution for young black people. What would you say to them?
Well, that is a corruption, hypocrisy, and you know, that is evil, because it's a promise of a career But that's racist promise, right? As for black people to take something to keep spilling their blood, you know, keep putting their lives to save or defend the interests of this country, interests that have nothing to do with black people. So I will say that is very racist, because what they have should be promoting is real education opportunities for black people, real job opportunities for black people that serve black people, that respond to the interests and the life purposes of black people. But what is not a life purpose for black people? And continue the spilling our blood and bringing our lives for defending interests that are not ours is a war crime. It is a crime against humanity. And that's what they are doing.
Right, this is Charo Minas Roja at the Pentagon on October 22nd. And thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'm talking to Emily Prater here at the Pentagon. And Emily's been an educator for a minute here.
Quite a long time, actually. But my question is, you're asking about the Army and how we're supporting the Army and the other armed forces, why the Democratic Party is doing that. Democratic Party has been supporting the downfall of education since Clinton, since, you know, we're talking about all the different programs that I'm working under that is keeping us from actually doing our job as teachers. And we still don't get paid anything. And part of the thing is that the Democratic Party will tout the Army to people who do not have the education as a way to get out of the situation that they are in. They're basically kind of handing off their job to the Army, and that is something that we really need to look into. If we actually educated kids, if we actually put in money into kids' education, especially in places, let's say in rural Georgia or rural Kentucky, rural places, where they don't get out of their counties. The kids don't ever leave their counties. There's no way that they could start thinking about things overseas. They don't even know what's outside of the state. And we're failing them. And of course they don't have any questions about foreign policy. They don't need to. The candidates, the local candidates, they don't need to, because nobody knows to ask these questions, because nobody travels outside of their own counties, especially in rural areas. My question is, if we start giving money to education, to teachers, to getting materials that teachers want instead of what we're given, to less testing, to trying to get the kids who are desperate to figure out how to get to better places outside of their areas and inside of their areas, if we can get to that, then possibly we can start talking about foreign policy. But for right now, nobody's supporting it, because nobody cares, except for the people who have gotten out. And that drives me crazy. There's a lot of people who haven't gotten out.
In Chicago, where I'm from, the past mayors have given one high school to the U.S. Army and then closed the public high school across the street from there. And they gave a half of another high school to the U.S. Navy. And for a while, they gave a middle school to the Marine Corps. They took that back, but the Navy still owns half of Senn High School. And there's still a military academy now, which is part of the Chicago public school system, allegedly. Well, what do you think of the military as a solution?
We have high school ROTC. We have kids who are learning how to shoot guns and getting ready to go into the Army. The Army or Armed Forces is touted for a way to get kids off of the streets. It's a way to give them discipline. It's a way to show them the world. That is ridiculous. Schools are the way to show them the world. Teachers are the way to show them the world, because teachers have a right to say anything that they want. They can tell their kids to vote for Trump if they want to. They can tell their kids to vote for whoever they want to. But Army people only tell their kids how to make war. That is all they do. That is their job. So how can we possibly think that we're doing a good job if that's what we're offering kids as the best option? And I'm saying kids who are in the Rust Belt, kids who are in Chicago, kids who are in your county of, is it Cherokee County?
Cobb.
Cobb County. I know Cobb County. I mean, I know what they don't have. Cobb County actually is pretty much luckier. You go a couple of counties out, there's nothing for them.
Yeah.
And they don't go anywhere. There's no jobs. There's nothing. And the only thing they got is join the armed forces. I know that. My family was told that. And it drives me crazy. We do this to poor people, and it drives me crazy. And there's no way to teach them how to get out. We keep that information to ourselves, and the Democratic Party keeps it to themselves.
And thank you, Emily Prater. Teen, I'm talking to
Mike Gimbel,
who says he was here 51 years ago.
Yes, I was a member of the U.S. Committee to Aid the NLF of South Vietnam. That's the Revolutionary Forces of South Vietnam. We were the ones carrying the revolutionary flags right up the Pentagon steps. This was a demonstration that was called by the overall anti-war movement in terms of confronting the Pentagon. But once they realized that we had organized with the Walter Teague's leadership, a revolutionary contingent that was actually intending to confront it and go up the steps of the Pentagon, they got cold feet, but we didn't. We led 50,000 people up the steps in that historic demonstration where you saw the troops facing off with us in a double line with their bayonets facing us. And that famous picture of the daisy going into the end of the rifle, that was 10 feet to my left. And we led that demonstration. Walter couldn't be there because he got arrested immediately when we went through the fences. But the rest of us, about four or five of us, led those 50,000 people all night in that confrontation, military confrontation with the troops up there, carrying the revolutionary flag of the Vietnamese right in front of the Pentagon 51 years ago.
51 years ago, they say they levitated the place, but apparently they only levitated it a fraction of an inch and set it down gently. Perhaps we can lift it up a little higher and drop it a little harder today. Who knows? I'm talking here to Sam Husseini.
Good to be with you.
Tell us, why is it you think that Democrats don't oppose the wars?
I think at root the Democratic Party is still part of the imperial military structure that dominates U.S. politics. And there's been some minor rhetorical distancing from that, but I think it's been at the margins. And, you know, I think the Democratic Party has gotten away with simply saying we're not the Republicans. And in a way, the Republicans have gotten away with just simply saying we're not the Democrats. And each party depends on the hypocrisy and the lies of the other to keep their bases basically locked up. So that's the way that politics works. So perpetual war making isn't seriously scrutinized.
This is Bruce Dixon at the Pentagon City Metro stop, where there are a number of people here getting ready to march on the Pentagon. And we're talking to Yanni Indigo, who's up here from Mississippi. And the question is, say hi.
Hi, how are you?
And the question is, we're going to get, in most cases, to choose between a Republican and a Democrat in less than 2 weeks. The problem is, none of the Democrats, in most cases, are against the war. What do we do?
Well, I think that, and that's part of the purpose of this march, is to first of all, bring attention to the fact that there's no established party in our government that is an anti-war party. So part of this is about education, and then about activating that educated stance and to speak against war and to speak against imperialism, both in the international imperialism and the domestic oppression, domestic war that's happening here. What we have to do is we have to recognize that the electoral system is not the process through which we are going to establish at this point a liberated reality, and to actually to stand against war, that we have to do that ourselves. We have to take agency in this system to understand how war is manifesting, and then what it is that we need to be putting pressure on our officials to stand against. So the the expansions of the war bases, for example, is something that we need to know is consistently happening. Those expansion of those war bases on the African continent is something that we need to understand is happening. And we need to also then understand and recognize the importance of demanding that these wars, these bases, these U.S. military bases are getting closed. They need to be getting closed. And we need to fight for that. We need to fight for the demilitarization of our police. We need to fight against the actual training of Israeli forces here in the U.S., in our own cities. We need to be educated about it so that we can actually stand against it and hold individuals in, accountable, but also recognizing that there's not a party that does that already. And there's not an electoral, there's not a mechanism within our electoral system that is already aligned with us. And so we need to fight against both parties, recognize that both of the major established parties are enemies of our efforts against war, and fight with that knowledge.
And I'm talking to Zaid Muhammad
from
actually today I'm helping the People's Organization for Progress. I do press for them.
So why is it that we don't have any Democrat elected officials against the war, man? What's up with that?
Because they're part of the problem. The United States is on a war footing. The United States has been on a war footing. You know, we this country has been at war since the turn of the century. And we're at a time, an obscene time, where nobody on that front is even willing to talk about it. It's absolutely mind-boggling because we're here today to observe the 51st anniversary of the March on Pentagon that really got a whole lot of attention back then. And it's you would think in this information age with so much at our disposal, we would be able to push this question of peace versus war to a whole different place. But we've got a whole lot of work to do to figure out how to do that in this particular age.
Well, a lot of our elected officials, including some of the black elected officials in places like New Jersey, are advancing the military as a career, as a solution for black youth. What do you think of that?
It is as backwards as the word go. It's a consequence of them being paid by those lobbying forces that pay them to do that. And it's a consequence, unfortunately, too, of the weakness of our movement at this particular moment. Even though there's the beginning of a resurgence of interest in trying to do things progressive, shutting things down, you know, in the streets around, things like police brutality, big picture struggle that raises those kind of contradictions, that puts out even our folks on blast, that's the way to go. We have some maturing to do on that front, and we need to do what we need to do, those of us who are veterans, right, to see that next generation and to calling them out and coming up with a new generation of leadership that understands and need the big picture stuff.
That was Black Agenda Report Managing Editor Bruce Dixon at the Women's March on the Pentagon. Police reform is a watchword of black politics. Most black officials claim to be in favor of stronger measures to restrain police violence. Nicole Siegel, an associate professor of sociology and Africana studies at Stony Brook University, has a new book titled Violence Work, State Power and the Limits of Police. She writes that police reform can't work because the rock-bottom function of the police is to do the work of the state, and the work of the state is violence.
Police are the force that make the violence of the state real. They are the people who bring that big abstract power of the state down to the human level and make it happen. They realize the power of the state. And that requires thinking a little bit about what the power of the state is at its most fundamental level. And I think that people who are in favor of police reform have a pretty benign sense of the state. And I would like to shift that over to remind people that the fundamental work of the state is to organize violence, especially the work of the capitalist market state. Maybe not the work of any state we could possibly imagine, but the work of the state that we know and that we have known in our lifetimes and in our era, you know, the era of European expansion, of African transatlantic slavery, and of colonialism, is the capitalist market state. And under that state, what we experience, especially what people of color, the poor, and other policed communities experience, is the violence that is the core of state power. So what I'm really trying to get folks to see, I think, or to wrestle with, is the fact that the state isn't going to save us at this point. And we need to see the violence of the state, and we need to see the people who exercise the violence of that state with clearer eyes. And those people are police. Police are not the only people who are doing the work of violence. There are other people who are involved in that too, like soldiers and prison guards and, you know, a whole bunch of other categories. That's why I like the term violence work or violence worker. But police are the folks who are kind of most obvious to us, and they're the people that are inspiring the most interesting protest movements right now. They're the people who are the objects of reformist attempts. So that's why I'm focusing on police here as the kind of quintessential violence workers that we can learn a lot about if we think about in this slightly different way.
States in general claim to have a right to a monopoly on violence, but what is it about capitalist states that makes them so lethal in their treatment of black and brown people?
Well, I think capitalist states need to generate surpluses, and then they need to soak up those surpluses. They need to generate surpluses of people to keep wages at a certain level, and they need to generate surplus populations, therefore. And they've done that in different ways in different phases of capitalism. But I think because the capitalist state is so focused on organizing the market and protecting people from the excesses of the market and protecting the market from the excesses of the people, that is, people who would like to escape market requirements, they have to wield that violence in certain ways. And the main way in, you know, the past 500 years that the market state has decided to organize violence is through race, is through institutions such as colonialism or plantations or transatlantic trade. All of these institutions require the intense violence of surplus populations or populations devoted to labor whose lives are expendable. And, you know, I think in our day, the institution that most marks the capitalist market state is the prison, is the system of mass criminalization, which maybe it's not right to say that it's the prison because it's so much more than the prison. It's also the hyper-policing of neighborhoods where black and brown and poor people live that police and the state have decided are the places where they can best expend the kinds of energies that will give them the political and economic feedback that they need. The work of violence extends into the ideological realm, right? It's not just about keeping some people idle for the suppression of wages. It's also about the psychological impact of whiteness, of the feeling of fear and protection, of the promise of protection when the fear of state violence is so clear and obvious and real to any observer. So I think the market is half the state, or the state is half the market, or the state and the market are so intermixed as to be irrevocably intertwined. And they require a certain set of violences together, and they generate them. And then they ask a group of people to put those violences into practice. And a lot of those people we call police.
The state has also taken on the responsibility of education, but imprisonment or policing is part of the state's educational system as well.
Yeah, it is. I mean, Althusser understood that very well when in thinking about education systems as ideological apparatuses, and Foucault understands them as disciplinary institutions. And, you know, I think we really need to think very critically about our educational systems, particularly the ones that have been so deeply altered by neoliberalism in the last 40 years. I mean, I think that a lot of my book is about the disappointments of hopes for state salvation under neoliberalism. That, for example, folks who were working and hoping in the 60s during the civil rights movement, they really placed a lot of faith in the state, and they thought that things like voting and laws could make a big difference, and integrating public education, you know, the university system. The U.S.'s really excellent public university system in the 1950s and 60s. And Then what we saw over the course of the 70s to now is just the total disintegration of those hopes. And in terms of the educational system, of the hollowing out of that system through its neoliberalization, you see tuition rising, state support falling, the ability to hope for fellowships and scholarship support eroding, student debt rising, curricula changing, so that getting a kind of critical all over arts and sciences education is now no longer possible except for the very elite few. And you see universities educating international populations rather than the local populations that, say, the land-grant institutions, such as the one that I teach for, were created to serve. And that's the sort of extension of the internationalization of the workforce, right? It's the internationalization of the student body educated by the U.S.'s public universities.
You know, one can look at the 60s and say that no sooner had the legislative arm of government granted blacks the right to vote and created some anti-poverty programs than the oppressive arm of government, the police and the prisons, created mass black incarceration.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely right. And there have been a bunch of works recently tracking that in federal and other branches of state policy. So I think of Vesa May Weaver, of her dissertation and article about frontlash, not backlash, but the ways that responses to the civil rights movement, they couldn't really make headway in the moral universe because the civil rights protesters had captured that universe. So they began to kind of go around the back door and create this legislation that would eventually build up mass criminalization. And Naomi Murakawa's wonderful book, The First Civil Right, is about how liberals were involved in that process and earlier than we think of. It wasn't a process that began with conservatives in the 1970s, but with both liberals and conservatives in the 1960s and even the 1950s. So that's not a conspiracy theory. It's a really well-documented historical process. It really is exactly what happened. To forestall social and racial justice, lawmakers created a new system of racial discipline to replace the one that was being dismantled by civil rights protesters. They dismantled Jim Crow segregation, and they created mass criminalization, which has eaten up, you know, not only the bodies of African Americans, but a range of racialized people, black and brown and poor. And now in the war on terror, we have to understand that system is also feeding off of the bodies of immigrants and people who are racialized as Muslims as well.
And as part of that process, you write of the Office of Public Safety, which is a federal agency, and how it, beginning in the 60s and 70s, spread the virus of racist state violence throughout the country and overseas.
First of all, it didn't spread it in this country by working in this country. It worked abroad. It was a group of police trainers who went abroad and trained other nations' police, allied nations. And it definitely took with it all of the U.S. policing system's strategies and tactics. And those strategies and tactics were already the product of lots of transnational exchange and the hybridity of military and civilian spheres, because the U.S. police have constantly gone abroad and come home and been nourished and educated by U.S. engagements globally, from wars of 1898 in the Philippines and the Caribbean to 1848, conflict with Mexico and the annexation of a large part of Mexico's northern territory, and the Indian Wars over the whole course of the 19th century and 18th and 19th centuries. And so U.S. police have cycled abroad and returned home and taken the tactics that they learned in war situations and situations of colonialism and of genocide abroad, and they have applied them here at home. So the Office of Public Safety is only the latest chapter, you know, at the moment that it occurs. It's no longer the latest chapter. There have been other chapters now since then. But in the moment of its lifetime, which is from 62 to 74, It is the latest iteration of U.S. police traveling abroad and applying U.S. policing tactics abroad, teaching them to other nations' police, and then taking that experience into all of the other things that they did in their later careers. The reason the Office of Public Safety is such a good object of study is because it was terminated by Congress in a way that its employees thought was premature, and they were furious, and they organized basically to stay in touch with each other as they went on to other careers. And they created a newsletter that they circulated amongst themselves, charting what they were doing after 1974, after the termination of their agency. And so through that newsletter, the historian, that is me or you or anybody who's interested in reading those newsletters, which are now archived at Indiana University, can get a sense of the kind of work that a person with police training and this kind of international travel is qualified to do. And then what you can see is people crossing all the borders that are supposed to contain policing. You can see them going easily over into military spheres. You can see them continuing to travel abroad. You can see them coming home and going back to work in police forces or in police academies or in prisons. You can see them going into all the branches of the federal police. The U.S. federal government has a number of police forces that operate there. And so you can see them violating the strictures of scale and locality. You can see them crossing the military-civilian blood-brain border. You can see them crossing over into public and private work, so lots of private security industry work. So they do bring some of that stuff home, and they do take some of it abroad. But we shouldn't understand it as a one-time effect, right? Taking from a coherent well of U.S. policing and just taking that abroad, or borrowing counterinsurgency, which is created by the military, and then bringing it home. We should see them instead as one phase of this constant cycle of police and military exchanging strategies, of police going abroad and coming home, and of government violence workers going over to the private sector and then returning and kind of mixing up, muddying the waters between public and private work.
Yes, I suppose their skills are fungible wherever the currency is violence.
That's right, yeah. I think that's true. That's a great way of saying it.
You focus a great deal on the concept of building consent for this racist violence. But the police in the United States seem to have long enjoyed massive white political consent for the violence that they do to black communities.
I mean, I think that part of the way white consent is secured is by doing violence to black communities, because that is one of the most powerful ways that the U.S. state gives value to whiteness, creates a possessive investment in whiteness, creates whiteness as property. It's very clear that the value of whiteness is enormous when you see what happens to black people at the hands of police.
So, blatant police violence, public violence against black people, actually shows white people how privileged they are.
That's right. I think it doesn't just show them something that already exists. I think it creates that privilege. It's one of the things that we can look at in order to understand the process of racial construction. And in the age of the war on terror, I think it shows us how racialization is shifting, that now the category of blackness or the category of the hyper-policed is extending to people who could be understood as, you know, Middle Eastern or brown or Muslim or immigrant. And I think that the categories of racialization are shifting subtly, but police remain one of the state's greatest engines of racialization. And also, I should say something about the violence work that police do. I'm not suggesting that police are constantly violent or that the only kind of violence work is the infliction of violence, you know, like killing somebody or beating somebody up. What I mean by violence work is work that is enabled by violence. It is violent sometimes, but in fact, the great majority of police work, you know, 95% of the time that a police officer is on the beat or greater, is not spent inflicting violence, but all of it is enabled by violence. All of it involves withheld violence, suspended violence, because the work of police is undergirded by the power to inflict violence if they deem it necessary. So I don't want people to get the sense that I think police are necessarily bad people or violent all the time. I think that lots of people become police with a desire to help their own communities. And I've had students in my own classes, including lots of people of color, who think that they want to become police or they want to become workers in a prison because they can actually help people there. They see so many of their community members in those systems, in neighborhoods that are hyper-policed or in prisons or in criminal justice systems. And they think, I can go there and I can make a difference. And what they discover, I think, is that those systems are brutalizing to the people who work in them as they are to the people who are caught up in them as objects. And the work of violence does not always involve the infliction of immediate physical violence. It can also be spatial enforcement, right? Keeping people in their place, whether that place is a neighborhood place or is an occupational place. It can be the reminder of the need to be hypervigilant. It can be a number of things that don't involve the actual infliction of violence, but that still have the effect of the violent enforcement of racial categories and the other social categories that structure power, including gender and sexuality, nation, and others like region and class that have a more varying applicability.
Which can bring us to the subject of community policing, a term that is ill-defined, but is usually associated with police doing more community work and more community folks interacting with the cops. But if you don't change the nature of the system, then it's still inherently violent.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think community policing is this wonderful euphemism. I mean, I remember in the 90s being excited about it as well. But what it really reflected, and I think people at the time didn't realize, and certainly in earlier periods didn't realize, is the evacuation of social service provision by the state and by people who are not violence workers, and the handing over of any social service provision that remains in the neoliberal state to police. So police have expanded their mandate to the point that they're the people who are doing sort of on the ground mental health services, or, you know, they're the people who are taking people to the hospital when they have a problem in a public place, or they're the people who are doing just all kinds of tasks that don't really require a badge and a gun to complete. They don't need to be violence work. And that's the basis of an anti-reformist abolitionist perspective on police, is understanding that there are so many things that police do that don't need to be done by police. And those could be handed over and those could be expanded, and they could become instead the core of a kind of another way of organizing our world that didn't rely on violence, didn't rely on the state. If we were able to take some of those tasks away from violence workers and take them on in a genuine community formation that didn't have anything to do with policing, that wasn't community policing, but that was community caring for itself, community deciding what it needed and how it wanted to provide what it needed and making those things happen.
That was Nicole Siegel, author of the new book, Violence Work. Rich people claim that they make the world a better place by giving a portion of their wealth to charity. But author and activist Julie Wark says rich people's philanthropy is profoundly self-serving because the system that makes them rich also creates poor people and the need for charity. Wark lives in Barcelona, Spain, and she's the author of the new book, Basic Income, The Material Conditions of Freedom.
We get actually began with the religious depictions of charity, which were, first of all, the Virgo Lactans, or charity, the Roman charity, where the Virgin is there magnanimously feeding little babies and curing saints with eye problems and all the rest of it. And then we go through things like charity is not a gift, and mainly based on the work of Marcel Mauss, and then the role of charity in all the different religions, as many as we could possibly cover, and then the new kind of burgeoning academic so-called discipline of altruism, and then the charity of the celebrities and mega-rich people. But yes, it does manufacture a need for charity, because I think that when you have such an intense concentration of wealth, so that we've got half the world is hungry, that's billions of people, and the freedom of the rest of us is being more and more clipped by the fact that these rich people are dominating everything from education through to the Davos summits and so on, and also destroying the planet as they do it. So it has to have something like a benign face. And this is where charity steps in. Before, I think we could argue that religion played some of this role, but now the high priests are basically the celebrities whom we're supposed to admire and want to be like.
Yes, it is rather obscene, isn't it? We have societies that are, in fact, ruled by the rich, who create the conditions in which they prosper, but millions of people are reduced to misery. And then the rich create charities which help a few of those people, and they want to be admired and praised for doing that.
Yes, I mean, you have Bill Gates, for example. He's one of my bête noires, who, you know, has a house with a garage for 26 cars, and it covers masses of land. He cuts down 500-year-old trees, and he has the nerve to call it Xanadu, so we're supposed to think of him as some kind of Kublai Khan. I mean, it really, I think charity really, really underpins the system in ways that hasn't been discussed. And even worse than that, it's very fertile ground for extreme corruption, which we discuss in Chapter 6 of the book, and Trump is a good example with his Trump Foundation, where with all kinds of tax law loopholes, they can stash away fortunes that we don't know about. And I think another thing which is even worse is that it's such an unequal relationship that the person who's receiving cannot reciprocate. And in the end, I think that this idea that there are human beings who have to depend on the arbitrary whims of rich people, it also helps with the notion that there are populations which Henry Kissinger would have called basket cases or redundant populations. So now in Spain, we have this situation of boats full of refugees and immigrants just being letting sink in the Mediterranean. Those people are redundant. Nobody wants them. And I think that charity, this idea that there are some people who are so hopeless they can't do anything for themselves and they have to be dependent on the likes of Bill Gates or people who engage in smaller kinds of charity, helps to reinforce this idea of basket case populations, whole populations. But of course, you know, then again, you know, there's acts of kindness, and we do go to some trouble to try and distinguish between charity and kindness. And of course, there are a lot of people who will create charities, like Paul Newman, for example, or Colin Kaepernick, or Winston Auden, the British poet, who are really sincere and trying to do something against this terrible system.
Whole countries have been reduced to basket cases, such as Haiti.
Yeah, that's the, let's call it the corruption ground of the Clintons par excellence. And we've devoted some part, because part of charity on the institutional scale, and this, we're talking about charity on the institutional scale, not particularly attacking all individuals, although there are some like the Clintons who deserve to be attacked. We talk about philanthropy and humanitarianism as institutional forms of charity, but of course they underpin the military-industrial system as well. And so if you read about what the Clinton Foundation actually did in Haiti, and even the American Red Cross, you know, is another really scandalous case where they received so much money after the earthquake and did absolutely nothing. For example, one very simple thing could have been to sort out the problem of the water supply, but they didn't do that. So now we've got thousands of people dying of cholera.
Now think of it. Here we have the Clintons, who subscribe to an ideology that says that Haiti, as the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, has an added advantage by being poor. That is, that its people will work for less money than anybody else. And people with this ideology are in charge of both the charity to Haiti and have great influence on the other affairs that influence how Haiti can be kept in a poor position.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Haiti is being called the NGO Republic. This means that private companies from the United States, including arms countries, because USAID has this connection with the military-industrial complex, so you've got armed soldiers there, and even the UN peacekeeping force. Why did they need a peacekeeping force after an earthquake? And these are the guys who introduced the cholera. So you've got this NGO Republic of foreign NGOs, where the local NGOs have absolutely no say in what's happened. And, you know, you can't help thinking when you look back at the history of Haiti that it's almost a historical punishment, you know, because it was the first slave republic in the history of the world. It's got an amazing history, but it's been crushed over and over and over again. The Clintons go there as Democrats and just contribute to the further destruction of the country. And in the grossest ways as well, by building, for example, a Marriott five-star hotel, which they call Building Back Haiti. It is obscene. Obscene is the right word, but not just a little bit obscene. It's extremely obscene.
In place of notions of charity, what you advocate is an unconditional, universal, basic income and entitlement.
Yes, this would be an income, which is our position on this is going back to the early Republican views, and the idea is that you cannot, unless you have the most basic human right of all, which is the right to material existence guaranteed, you cannot exercise any, it's obvious, you cannot exercise any of the other rights. And so for me, Danny comes, my co-author, comes at it as an economist and sociologist, and I come at it as an anthropologist and sociologist, but from the human rights perspective. You know, it's a basic human rights. You cannot, unless you have your means of material existence guaranteed, you cannot exercise your other rights. So what we did was to discuss it in terms of justice and in terms of can do. And it can be done with progressive taxation, and we've proved it with a very meticulous study here in Spain and Catalonia. What it means is that the top 10% would lose. They would receive the basic income, but they'd pay more in tax. Maybe another 20 or 15% would break even, but everybody else would gain. But the basic income would, of course, have to be above the poverty line.
Here in the United States, there's some discussion of this universal basic income. In fact, some very rich people from Silicon Valley are talking about it. But they seem to be speaking not of an income that is sufficient to cover folks' basic needs, but a supplement, $500, maybe $800 a month. And it seems very curiously like a supplement to the kind of gig economy, the terrible things that pass for jobs that these same rich people are producing in this country.
Yeah, I mean, this is just their view of it. I mean, it's happened over and over again. Good ideas on the left get appropriated by the right, who then try to water them down and turn them into something else, but still using the same name to discredit the left. So, I mean, this can go back to von Mises and the Chicago School, who also advocated something that they called a basic income. But with the Finland experiment, for example, which is quite recent, the idea of the right wing is to abolish all welfare services. and then make the population dependent on their whim of the amount of money they think they should get. And also, you can bet your life that it won't be unconditional. They'll start imposing all kinds of conditions. So, you know, we've got to be a well-behaved, self-policing public in order to get what they decide to give us. So our version of basic income, as we're careful to say, this is not a revolutionary measure. It could be revolutionary when everybody is empowered by having an income so they don't have to worry about staying alive or feeding their kids or having a roof over their heads. And for us, it's part of a package which would come with a reinforced social services like health, education, etc., which would make a much stronger society. But of course, the Silicon Valley guys aren't remotely interested in that.
Yes, and just as workers are more likely to assert their rights if they have a strike fund, working regular people would be more likely to assert their democratic rights if they had a basic income to fall back on.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. They have a cushion. And I mean, you could have, if you had, say, three friends who receive a basic income above the poverty line, they can say, okay, we're leaving the factory, we're going to start bike repair work. Workshop. And I mean, this would also re-establish the economy from the base, you know, with small businesses instead of this incredible concentration of businesses like things that nobody really wants. And there's so much useless stuff being produced now. Whereas, for example, in my neighborhood, it's full of very expensive dress shops, but you can't buy a loaf of bread anymore. And also imagine what it would mean for women who are completely dependent on their husbands. And there's some very good feminist work done on this by people like Carol Pateman and so on about what a basic income would mean for women. It's a form of autonomy, liberation, call it what you like, but they're not having to ask their husbands for money. And also, in a violent or bad marriage, they can leave.
In terms of the political viability of an unconditional universal basic income, here in the United States, we did have some minimal obligations by the state to the people in the form of a welfare system, a welfare entitlement. But President Clinton, a Democrat, did that in.
Yes. The beautiful thing about our version of the basic income is that it's unconditional and universal. So with these two very important factors, it means that a lot of the surveillance and bureaucratic structure that goes with the welfare system would be abolished, and that would be more money towards paying for the basic income. You'd save an awful lot of money by doing away with these monitoring systems that are very characteristic of welfare systems around the world today, such as they are now. But yeah, you're right about what Clinton did. And also with the tax laws, with the Glass-Steagall Act, where people can hardly believe that once the rich were taxed something like 90% of their incomes. And we should go back to that. You know, this is intolerable, this situation of having, depending on what you read, between 8 or 20 people having as much wealth as half the world.
Yes, the universal basic income is, unlike welfare, not means-tested. It's an entitlement for everybody, just like Social Security is in the United States.
Yeah, well, it's a universal human right. It's not welfare, it's a human right that is taken for granted that everybody has the right to material existence. And you can imagine what this would mean in third world countries, you know, because now we have this situation of hundreds of thousands of refugees being warehoused, that people use this term, in these massive camps, for example, in Kenya and different African countries, which can hardly manage their own populations, let alone a couple of million refugees. So it's a way of tackling problems. Some problems, I mean, it's not a total solution or nothing like it, but it's a way of tackling racism, exclusion, discrimination. No, because once it's universal, then we have to think differently about society.
Well, yes, if we're talking about a universal human right, that changes the conversation. For example, if we were talking about a universal basic income in the United States, one could put a price tag on that. But if we're talking about a human right, then countries like the United States and Britain and the rich countries of the world would have to recognize the universal human right of the folks in what we used to call the third world, who have been impoverished by the first world.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, I think it also, once you let this idea of universal rights in the door, for example, I was born in Australia, and the Australian government is one of the most racist governments on the face of the earth, and they have refugees held prisoner in Nauru, which is a rock in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and in terrible conditions, including young children, like as children prisoners in the United States as well. But once you let the concept of universal in, I think it's going to be much more difficult to treat people like basket cases or redundant populations or surplus populations. Because once you accept the idea of universal human rights, you cannot let those concepts flourish. I love the concept. I love the idea of basic income because of all the sort of added values that comes with it philosophically.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.